Attention listeners, AfterSight's annual hike is coming up on July 27th.
It was a really good experience for me.
Visit aftersight.org/hike and become an audio trekker today.
That hike today gave me so much courage.
Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Boulder, Longmont, and Northern Colorado News, read by Jerry Gingram. This is being recorded on April 26th, Friday. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. Officials look to encourage affordable homes, written by Amber Carlson. Bill protects officers reporting misconduct, written by Bruce Finley. Leaders release plan to achieve zero emissions, written by Olivia Doak, and following up with miscellaneous articles. Zoning. Officials look to encourage affordable homes. Council members discuss several ways to add more density around city. Boulder officials are working to change existing residential zoning laws in hopes of making housing more affordable as home prices continue to rise. The Boulder City Council on Thursday discussed some additional changes to its zoning laws beyond what the council approved last fall as part of the city's Zoning for Affordable Housing project. The changes were meant to remove zoning barriers to build more affordable and modest-sized housing in Boulder. While last fall's zoning changes didn't represent an overhaul of Boulder zoning policies, they did include changing many of the standards, making it easier for developers to build townhouse complexes, duplexes, and triplexes in certain zones. Officials also modified density calculation requirements to allow more housing. But the conversation about zoning didn't end there. Although the council passed an ordinance last fall to adopt the zoning changes, council members at the time made several other suggestions of other possible zoning changes they were interested in exploring. Carl Geiler, a senior policy advisor for Boulder, told the Daily Camera ahead of Thursday's meeting that staffers had analyzed the council's suggestions and their findings had shown some areas of opportunity for more housing to be built. If we use a gross density calculation, there's quite a bit of room to make changes to add more housing, he said. But council members have to give us their policy read on what is consistent with the Boulder Valley Comprehensive Plan. During the meeting, Geiler gave a presentation detailing the council members' suggestions and staffers' findings. Some of the ideas council members pitched included finding ways to add more density in lower, medium, and mixed-density residential zones. Mixed-density zones include areas near downtown, such as the Goss Grove neighborhood, where single-family homes and apartment buildings exist side by side. According to the presentation, city staffers supported adding density in these zones. At Thursday's meeting, Geiler said the community has given mixed feedback about proposed zoning changes. People in favor of opportunities to add more housing have said proposed changes could allow more people to find housing in Boulder or continue living in the city. Some people who opposed or were cautious about building more housing expressed skepticism that increasing the housing supply would actually make housing more affordable, particularly because demand is so high. Some residents in single-family areas were concerned about increasing density or adding more housing types in their neighborhoods. Council members asked questions of city staff and talked about possible zoning changes, but they did not conclude their discussion before the Daily Camera's print deadline. Police oversight. Bill protects officers reporting misconduct. State law enforcement leaders object, saying they weren't given a chance to shape legislation. Former Edgewater Police Officer Mackenzie Reese hopes to serve and protect again. But first, she must get her name removed from a so-called bad cops list maintained by the Colorado Attorney General's office. It landed there, she said, as a retaliation after she reported sexual assaults by a supervising sergeant. That sergeant went on to work for another police department until this year, when he pleaded guilty to unlawful sexual contact and misconduct and was sentenced more than 4 years after the assaults and retaliation against Reese. She testified to the state's House Judiciary Committee this week that even after her attacker was exposed, her complaint about still being listed as a problem police officer is falling on deaf ears every time. Reese's testimony, echoed by other frontline police officers from Colorado Springs and Denver about retaliation they faced after reporting misconduct, is driving state lawmakers' latest effort at police oversight. Fresh legislation would require investigations of all alleged misconduct and increase protection for whistleblowers. But the bill, titled Law Enforcement Misconduct, faces resistance from police chiefs, sheriffs, district attorneys, and the Fraternal Order of Police, who contend it would complicate police work and lead to unnecessary prosecutions. While state leaders are committed to addressing police misconduct, the requirement that all allegations must be investigated could create a caustic culture within police agencies, said Colorado Department of Public Safety Executive Director Stan Hilke in testimony to lawmakers during a hearing Tuesday. This bill is harmful to the mission of public safety, Hilke said, raising concerns it would lead to police watching each other instead of going out and responding to and preventing crime. The legislation, House Bill 1460, won approval on a 6-5 vote in the House Judiciary Committee. It would require investigations of all alleged misconduct by police, correctional officers, and others who enforce the law in Colorado. Officers who report misconduct would gain the ability to file lawsuits if complaints aren't investigated or they face retaliation. Key elements under discussion include a provision bolstering the Attorney General's power to add and remove names from the Police Officer Standards and Training Database, which bars future employment, and to compel police agencies to provide information for managing that list. Other provisions would require longer retention of police records and prohibit government agencies from charging fees for making unedited police body-worn camera videos available for public scrutiny. Investigating all alleged misconduct is projected to cost millions of dollars as state agencies face increased workloads, requiring more employees in some agencies, and increased litigation and liability expenses. Lawmakers sponsoring the bill have agreed to remove a provision that would have established a new misdemeanor crime for officers who fail to report misconduct by their peers. But the increased protection for whistleblowers is essential, said Representative Leslie Harrod, a Denver Democrat, in an interview. People need those protections now. This would ensure good officers can be good officers, and bad officers who cover up for bad officers no longer can be on the force, said Harrod, who introduced the legislation on April 17th. Most police officers do great work, sponsor says. The bill would build on police accountability laws passed following the 2020 Minneapolis police murder of George Floyd, which sparked street protests, Harrod said. We still have more work to do. There's no one-shot bill that will fix police accountability in the state, she said. The majority of police officers in Colorado do great work. We need to make sure we have protections in place when that doesn't happen. This is just as important as any other issue we are debating in Colorado. The late-in-the-session legislation would affect the 246 police agencies and 12,000 sworn officers around Colorado. It began when Reese and other police whistleblowers who had faced retaliation approached lawmakers. For Reese, 30, who now supports herself by pet-sitting, the feeling of still being punished and prevented from continuing a career she worked toward since childhood is horrible, she said in an interview. There should always be checks and balances, she said. It is exhausting trying to figure this out. You just get this runaround. There's no way out. Reese told lawmakers that she reported two sexual assaults in 2019 by the sergeant to colleagues seeking protection under internal agency protocols and as a whistleblower under existing state laws. Instead, I got served the ultimate sentence of no protection, she said. This year, after his dismissal from the Black Hawk Police Department, former Edgewater Police Sergeant Nathan Giridis, who was indicted by a grand jury in 2022 on four counts of unlawful sexual contact and one count of witness retaliation, pleaded guilty to unlawful sexual contact, first-degree official misconduct, and forgery as part of a plea deal. He was sentenced in Jefferson County District Court to 4 years of probation. Edgewater Police Officer Ed McCallan also testified, describing the retaliation he faced after he became aware that a senior officer had sexually assaulted a junior officer, referring to Reese, and then weaponized the state's database against her. I was asked to cover that up by my police chief, he said. I was threatened with internal investigations twice and had to meet with a city council member to save my job for doing the right thing. When he went to the Fraternal Order of Police for guidance in the case, McCallan said, a contract attorney advised him to look the other way. We just need more time, the sheriff says. Colorado law enforcement group leaders and police advocates said their main concern was that they weren't consulted by sponsors of this legislation. We just need more time to dive into this, Arapahoe County Sheriff Tyler Brown, representing the county sheriffs of Colorado, told lawmakers. Herod acknowledged miscalculation in not consulting with law enforcement brass in advance. She and co-sponsor Representative Jennifer Bacon, a Denver Democrat serving as vice chair of the House Judiciary Committee, said they lined up meetings this week to hash out language and amendments before the bill advances. Representative Mike Weissman, who chairs the committee, agreed that support from law enforcement leaders would be crucial, but added that he understood the guardedness of the police sponsors, given how these issues can go in this building. District attorneys from Jefferson and El Paso counties objected to the proposed requirement that every misconduct claim must be investigated, saying it would create conflicts in carrying out their professional duties. Several lawmakers raised concerns about language in the bill, such as unlawful behavior. Representative Matt Soper, a Delta Republican, said a police officer who was sexually assaulted and chose not to report the crime could become caught up in the system for failing to report misconduct, or police who might have to make an illegal U-turn while chasing a suspect, hypothetically, would have to be investigated, he said. But the lawmakers broadly supported the efforts aiming at making sure the Attorney General's office manages the database of police transgressors properly. The committee's bill supporters said the compelling testimony from the Edgewater officers and other whistleblowers persuaded them that there's an undeniable problem to address. Former Colorado Springs police officer John McFarland told of a case in which a fellow officer took shortcuts in DUI investigations and falsely reported hundreds of roadside sobriety tests that never happened. When McFarland learned of the misconduct and reported it, he said, I was sat in the corner and surrounded by the department's command staff. I was threatened with charges and dismissal if I did not drop the matter. Former Denver police officer Holland Whiston, who was a victim of sexual assault, told lawmakers she faced ridicule within the police department and later was relegated to desk duties. CU Boulder. Leaders release plan to achieve zero emissions. Updated climate plan could cost from $800 million to $1.4 billion. The University of Colorado Boulder released a plan on Thursday outlining steps to achieve a 50% reduction in campus emissions by 2030 and a reduction to zero emissions no later than 2050. The Climate Action Plan basically sets us on a path to get us to zero emissions by 2050, said Chris Ewing, CU Boulder Vice Chancellor for Infrastructure and Sustainability. CU Boulder's Climate Action Plan, first created in 2009 and updated this year, establishes a plan for the university to achieve its climate goals. The updated plan includes more specific targets and steps to achieve those goals. CU Boulder Chief Operating Officer Pat O'Rourke said CU Boulder needs to not just have a plan, but be able to execute it. Now is the point where we hit a transition, which is from design to action, O'Rourke said. One goal of the plan is to achieve a 50% reduction in Scope 1 and 2 emissions by 2030. Scope 1, about 18% of total campus emissions, refers to carbon emissions from natural gas burned to create heat and power on campus. Scope 2 is energy purchased from Xcel Energy for the electricity on campus, making up about 32% of emissions. The university aims to achieve a 50% reduction by 2030 for Scope 3 emissions, with an ultimate goal to reach zero emissions by 2050. Scope 3 emissions result from the university's operations, including purchasing, business travel, and employee and student commuting. It takes up about half of CU Boulder's total emissions. The university does not have direct control over some Scope 3 emissions, which will make it more difficult to reduce. It's very clear there's a lot of work to do there, and we're scratching the surface of it, Ewing said. As we get more clarity and more detail around Scope 3, we'll be able to outline what needs to happen in the coming year. The updated plan was announced Thursday during CU Boulder's annual Campus Sustainability Summit during the Campus Leadership Panel. CU Boulder Chief Communications Officer John Leslie said CU Boulder has an opportunity to be a leader in North America, if not the world. 5 years from now, I would love for folks to think of the University of Colorado Boulder when they think of who the real leader is in advancing climate solutions that are helping us solve the human impacts of the crisis we are facing, Leslie said. The plan is estimated to cost between $800 million and $1.4 billion. A lot of that is for infrastructure upgrades, O'Rourke said. There are certain things we have to do as part of our regular budget, but there's big projects we are going to have to fill. This summer, CU Boulder will seek approval from the University of Colorado Board of Regents to add solar power on East Campus and begin work on 18 efficiency projects related to heat and power. More than 180 buildings on the main campus are heated by steam and need to be converted to a low-temperature hot water system. It is a huge project, and it is a huge undertaking, Ewing said, adding, "It's hundreds of millions of dollars to make that conversion, but we're excited to get started." CU Boulder does not yet have all the funding it'll need to execute the Climate Action Plan. Some funding will need to come from campus assets and cash, grants and state and donor support. One of the things we're going to have to do is balance, because it's not fair to say we're going to ask the students to bear the cost of our upgrades and sustainability needs, O'Rourke said. One project already underway is the Williams Village Residence Hall work to convert the heating system away from steam to hot water. Additionally, CU Boulder plans to transition to electric buses and currently has four that are all electric. Any new buildings, including two new residence halls and a new chemistry and applied math building, will be constructed sustainably and in line with the university's emission targets, officials said. Now we have a set of commitments and principles that we need to follow and honor those commitments to the community, O'Rourke said. Today, senior fish off, 6:30 a.m., Wally Tove's Pond at Walden Ponds Wildlife Habitat, 3893 North 75th Street, Boulder. The trout have fattened up and are biting. Prizes will be awarded for heaviest rainbow trout, most experienced, oldest, angler, best fishing hat, and first to catch the limit. Don't miss the fish fry after prizes. Free, 303-678-6219, boco.org. Lauren Freehauf at Boco Cider, 6 p.m. Boco Cider, 1501 Lee Hill Drive, Unit 14, Boulder. Lauren Freehauf is a rising star talent, has been recognized on NPR Music's 2022 Tiny Desk Top Shelf and Season 19 of NBC's The Voice, where she made waves on Team's Gwen and Legend. Listeners frequently compare her with Joni Mitchell, Amy Winehouse, and Madison Cunningham. Free, 720-938-7285, bococider.com. Middle School Ensembles Concert, 7 p.m., Nevin Platt Middle School, 6096 Baseline Road, Boulder. The 2024 Middle School Ensembles program presents its closing concert. MSE is an inclusive, collaborative experience for middle school music students, high school musicians considering a career in music teaching, and music education majors at CU Boulder's College of Music. This program provides a supplemental musical experience to school-based music programs for 6th to 8th grade students across all socioeconomic backgrounds in the Boulder Valley School District and other districts, fostering opportunities for future music educators. This concert will feature the MSE String Orchestra, MSE Silver Band, and MSE Gold Band. Free, 303-492-8008, cupresents.org. CU Brazilian Fusion at Full Cycle Cafe, 7:30 p.m., Full Cycle Bar and Cafe, 2355 30th Street, Boulder. Colorado's top musicians' coverage to combine high-energy salsa grooves with driving Brazilian bossas and sambas. Their infectious blend will certainly get listeners on their feet. The Cuban-Brazilian All-Stars feature Guy Kroneberger, Alejandro Castaña, Leo Corona, Bill Copper, Raul Murciano, and Gonzalo Tepa. $20 to $25. 303-440-1002, fullcyclecafebar.com. Yoga with Goats at Growing Gardens, 10 a.m. Saturday, Growing Gardens, 1630 Hawthorne Avenue, Boulder. Join a local yoga instructor as they guide participants through a one-hour vinyasa yoga class with goats positioned at the base of the foothills in the orchard on Growing Gardens Urban Farm, $35, growinggardens.org. Celebrate World Migratory Bird Day, 10:30 a.m. Saturday, George Reynolds Branch, 3595 Table Mesa Drive, Boulder. World Migratory Bird Day is a global celebration dedicated to appreciating and raising awareness about the incredible journeys undertaken by migratory birds. This annual event, observed worldwide, highlights the importance of conserving their habitats and promoting international cooperation to protect these avian wonders. Fly into Reynolds Library and visit with Environment for Americas that will bring fun games for children and families, enriching information and ways to get involved. Calendar.boulderlibrary.org. Dead Fish Orchestra at the Velvet Elk Lounge, 8 p.m. Saturday. The Velvet Elk Lounge, 2037 13th Street, Boulder. Dead Fish Orchestra is a well-established and well-loved quartet of Colorado musicians whose roots together go back more than two decades and who have shared stages literally thousands of times. What started out as a lark and got tagged with a tongue-in-cheek band name turned out to have some serious staying power. $22, 303-993-8743, etix.com. Carolyn Rose at Fox Theater, 8 p.m. Saturday. The Fox Theater, 1135 13th Street, Boulder. A witty, clever, and eclectic singer and songwriter, Carolyn Rose is a musician not afraid to evolve in public, growing from a contemporary folky to an Americana artist with roots rock leanings to a sharp-humored indie pop performer. As a songwriter, Rose is unafraid to look deep inside their psyche, and the melodies are engaging whether they were exploring the earnest moods of early work. shifting gears to a playfully fractured pop approach, or embracing their own vision of contemporary pop. $25 to $30, z2ent.com. Housing. Hope for Boulder commercial real estate? Experts sees momentum in the sector despite national business, political trends, written by Lucas High. Despite persistent headwinds from rising interest rates to the post-COVID-19 work-from-home revolution, commercial real estate activity in the Boulder Valley may be poised for increased activity in the middle and back half of 2024. There is nothing to jump up and down about. The numbers are what they are. But I think there is enough good momentum and a little bit of an energy shift that I think with baby steps it'll get a little bit better and better, Becky Gamble, CEO of the brokerage Dean Callen and Company, told BizWest this week. We've been having headwinds that are out of our control, like on the geopolitical side of the equation. It's out of our control, but it does impact companies' decision-making when it comes to building and leasing new commercial space, she said. Certainly, interest rates are important. So is the cost of capital, which impacts companies' ability to expand and to hire. In Boulder County, the total office vacancy rate, not including life science-centric flex space, was 22.4% in the first quarter of 2024, according to a new report from Dean Callen and Company. Of that total, 6% represent subleases. In the wake of the pandemic, companies that have traditionally been office tenants are still grappling with questions such as, what does it look like when we come back? How much space will we need? Gamble said. The answers to those questions, she said, often depend on the tenant's industry sector. But the days of 9-to-5 workdays in the office for certain segments are probably gone. Still, lease activity is trending in the right direction in many of the region's submarkets. In downtown Boulder, about 28.8% of office space was vacant in the first quarter of this year. While higher than pre-pandemic, that figure is down from 29.2% in the same period last year, according to Dean Callen and Company data. Transactions in the downtown submarket doubled year over year to 10 in the first quarter of 2024. Inquiries are picking up, so that's good, even in the office realm, Gamble said. That's generally good news, but whether inquiries will translate into actual lease execution, that is to be determined. Countywide, the commercial sales volume rose from $44.7 million in the first quarter of 2023 to $64.9 million in the most recent quarter, according to the Dean Callen report. Biotechnology flex spaces have been a red-hot space for developers in the Boulder area, as a host of new and redeveloped projects are expected to hit the market in the coming months and years. Whether those hundreds of thousands of office, research, laboratory, and manufacturing square feet will be immediately gobbled up by tenants remains to be seen. Some life sciences companies have struggled to get funding, Gamble said. I think the VC market is still slow, which affects biotech companies' abilities to take over new offices, manufacturing plants, and R&D facilities. We went from having nothing when the demand was crazy to having product being developed in a demand environment that has somewhat cooled, she said. You've got some of these projects that have been completed and are now ready for that demand to return. There is a silver lining related to commercial real estate vacancy in that it offers the chase for an injection of new blood into a community's business ecosystem, Gamble said. There's an opportunity for companies that have not had a chance to get into Boulder, whether it was too expensive or there wasn't the right size of office space available, she said. When one door closes, another one opens. The landscape has changed a bit so that companies that before might not have had the opportunity to be here can now be here. Gamble predicted that the Boulder area in coming years could see an increased presence from aerospace and defense industry tenants, along with more technology companies in the quantum computing realm. The business of beer. Fort Collins' newest brewery now open, written by Tiny Ricciardi. A new brewery with a familiar name is now open in Fort Collins. This week, Verboten Brewing and Barrel Project opened its second location at 1611 South College Avenue in the space formerly home to Black Bottle Brewery. It's currently in soft opening mode and will celebrate a grand opening the weekend of May 3rd, said co-owner Josh Grentz. Verboten took over Black Bottle's lease in February, and Grentz has since been working on a cosmetic model to update the bar tops, tabletops, and chairs. He downsized the draft system to 20 taps from 40 and added German-style picnic tables to the front patio. As part of the deal, Verboten also inherited the roughly 7-barrel brewing system on site. And since March, brewer Hunter Pierce has been busy at work churning out original recipes. The opening lineup in FOCO includes a couple Czech-style pilsners served from LUKR faucets, two India pale ales, a stout with coconut and cinnamon, a Kolsch, a Scottish export, and the last keg of the award-winning Grow Old With You barley wine. Grint said the Fort Collins location will brew all its beers in-house except for 4 core recipes that will be distributed from its flagship spot in Loveland. Those include an orange honey blossom wheat called Thinking of Something Orange, thawed out cold IPA, Verboten Pilsner, and a caramel porter called Killer Boots. During the grand opening weekend, bartenders will tap an Imperial Saison aged in gin barrels for the occasion, and thereafter the brewery anticipates starting a weekly Kolsch service, a German tradition that includes continuous beer delivery to each drinker, Grant said. Grant said he hopes Fort Collins will add to the Verboten experience, which is why he's trying to make it unique. In addition to beer, Verboten will serve food such as Detroit-style pizza, and small shareable plates. It's also expanding the beverage menu to include a limited selection of cocktails, wine, and non-alcoholic options. Though Verboten only took over the lease a few months ago, its owners had long desired to find a second tap room. The first opened in Loveland in 2013. Grintz began looking in 2019 before the pandemic shelved his plans. When the opportunity to move into Black Bottle space presented itself, it was too good to pass up, said Grintz, a Fort Collins native. We were looking for a place to expand where we could do something new. So having the food and cocktails gives us the ability to expand our knowledge and work with food and beer together, he said. Grintz also hopes to incorporate beer into the food and cocktail offerings. For example, the Verboten Old Fashioned features a smoked malt simple syrup, and the house margarita includes a hop sugar rim on the glass. Verboten Brewing and Barrel Project in Fort Collins will be open every day of the week from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. BNSF development. Hudson and Loch Buoy dispute who should vote in annexation election. Written by Christopher Wood. Hudson and Loch Buoy battling over competing annexations around the massive BNSF Railway Company development have found another issue to dispute before a planned annexation election. Exactly who should vote? Both towns have initiated annexations for the same portions of Weld County Roads 4, 41, and 45. Hudson, as part of the planned MSLCAT annexation, and Loch Buoy as part of South Weld annexations 2 and 3. Loch Buoy filed a petition for an annexation election in Weld County District Court February 1st, noting the overlapping annexations undertaken by the two towns. The parties held a status conference March 13th, agreeing on the areas of conflicting annexations, but disagreeing on who may participate as electors. In competing filings submitted to Weld County District Court on April 17th, the two southeastern Weld County towns provided differing interpretations of state law that governs annexations elections. State law provides that landowners and registered electors are eligible to vote in annexation elections. Loch Buoy, in a filing submitted by attorneys Joseph Rivera and Gerald Dahl with the law firm of Murray, Dahl, Beery and Renaud, LLP, stated that only Weld County, as owner of the rights-of-way, should vote in the election. Weld County is the only voter entitled to vote in the election because, one, the area claimed by both municipalities consists entirely of real property reserved for use as public rights of way, and, two, Weld County reserved the surface of the area at issue for use as public rights of way in 1889, Lockbuie's attorney stated. Under the Municipal Annexation Act and related case law, public rights of way are not owned by any of the underlying landowners. Instead, for the purpose of determining ownership of the area to be annexed and determining contiguity, all public rights of way are treated as a separate and distinct interest in real property. Hudson, in a filing by attorneys Nicholas Hartman and Hillary Graham of Hoffman, Parker, Wilson, and Carberry, P.C., states that 45 property owners abutting Weld County Roads 4 or 41, 34 have deeds and or recorded exemption plats showing an ownership interest from the private property is retained to the center line of the applicable right-of-way, and in one case, the entire right-of-way. Regardless of the county's ability to access and use the right-of-way, the official platting of the county shows that these 34 landowners retain an ownership interest in the right-of-way to the center line, the filing states. These individuals pay taxes to the center line of the respective rights-of-way and therefore should be allowed a vote in the conflicting annexation election. It's unclear when the court will rule on the dispute. Flagpole annexations. BNSF's planned development encompasses about 2,700 acres along BNSF tracks east of Interstate 76, roughly north of Weld County Road 4 and south of Weld County Road 10, with some parcels extending eastward toward Weld County Road 47. Analysts have estimated that the project could generate billions of dollars in economic activity. BNSF has not submitted annexation petitions to either town, but the two communities have begun annexations of surrounding properties. Annexations of rights-of-way such as those contemplated by Hudson and Lockbuie are dubbed flagpole annexations because they use a street or a road as a pole to reach a certain property or a flag. Hudson is considering the MSLCAT annexation, 120 acres owned by Don Sack, at the southwest corner of Weld County Roads 4 and 45. The property would provide a new facility for Mountain States Line Constructors Joint Apprenticeship and Training, which serves the electrical construction industry. But the MSLCAT annexation also includes rights-of-way along I-76 Frontage Road, southwest from Hudson to the Lockbuie town limits, along with rights-of-way along Weld County Roads 4, 41, and 45. Lockbuie has initiated annexation proceedings for South Weld Annexation Numbers 1, 2, and 3. South Weld Annexation Number 1 includes 194 acres immediately south of the planned BNSF facility at the northeast corner of I-76 and Weld County Road 4. The property is part of 700 acres owned by South Weld Holdings, LLC, an affiliate of Bromley Coase. South Weld Annexation Number 1 does not conflict with planned Hudson annexations, but South Weld Annexations 2 and 3 would include rights-of-way that overlap with Hudson's annexations. Separately, Hudson in February approved the long annexation, including 323 acres between BNSF's intermodal development and New Logistics Park. The property is near the northwest and southwest corners of Weld County Roads 8 and 45. Hospitality. 8 hotels across Colorado awarded with new Michelin keys, written by Juliana O'Claire. 8 Colorado hotels won the new Michelin keys on Wednesday, according to the Michelin Key Hotel Guide. Each of these Colorado hotels received one Michelin key. 3 of the winning hotels are in Denver: the Clayton Hotel and Members Club, Four Seasons Denver, and the Crawford Hotel. 3 hotels in Aspen: Hotel Jerome, part of the Auberge Resorts collection, the Little Nell and Molly Aspen, and 2 in Vail: Four Seasons Vail and Sun and Lap Hotel, were also awarded the distinction. Michelin is a prestigious organization, and being one of only 8 hotels in Colorado to receive a key is a great honor. Thierry Kennel, Four Seasons Hotel Denver Regional Vice President and General Manager, said, "According to Michelin, hotels with one Michelin key offer a very special stay. This is a true gem with its own character and personality. It may break the mold, offer something different, or simply be one of the best of its type," a Wednesday Michelin news release states. "Service always goes the extra mile and provides significantly more than similarly priced establishments. 2 keys denote an exceptional stay, while 3 keys denote an extraordinary stay. Awarded based on anonymous visits made by Michelin staff." The Michelin key was created to guide travelers to accommodations that stand out for their warm welcomes, unique hospitality concepts, distinctive characters, and high levels of service, according to the release. The first Michelin key winners were announced in France on April 8th. On Wednesday, Michelin unveiled the 124 hotels in the United States, selected out of almost 1,000 U.S. hotels in the Michelin Guide, that were awarded 1, 2, or 3 Michelin keys. Similar to Michelin stars, U.S. hotels in Atlanta, California, Chicago, Colorado, Florida, New York, and Washington, D.C. were eligible for the award. "We are honored to have been awarded one of the first Michelin Guide keys," Ed Blair, the Crawford Hotel's area general manager, said. "We are continuing to elevate the Crawford guest experience and are excited to celebrate the entire Denver Union Station refresh with our community this July." The staff of Clayton Hotel and Members Club received the news on Wednesday afternoon. "We opened the Members Club and Hotel in the height of the pandemic, a place for connection, for creativity, for diversity, and obviously opening in a pandemic. And obviously, opening in a pandemic, it was incredibly challenging," Lydia Howardon, the general manager of Clayton Hotel and Members Club, said. "Since that day, we have been devoted to recruiting and training a team that can offer best-in-class hospitality, and to see that finally coming to life and being honored on this level is really amazing." Service above self. Boulder Rotary to honor 4 at annual gala. Written by Dana Cady. The Boulder Rotary Club will recognize 4 local individuals for their hard work, dedication, and community impact at the club's 3rd annual Service Above Self gala. Set for Saturday evening at the Boulder Country Club, the event is a chance to honor community members outside Boulder Rotary who embody the club's motto of Service Above Self. "We wanted to share hope with the community," said Sally Brown, past president of Boulder Rotary and event co-chair. "There are really great people out there who care a lot about the Boulder community." Every year, Boulder Rotary receives nominations for the gala's honorees from club members and non-Rotarians. Anyone who has served the Boulder area within the last 2 to 3 years is up for consideration. "We had truly spectacular people this year," event co-chair Kitty DeKiefer said of the nominees. "We had so many that picking the 4 was pretty hard to do, but these 4 really were stellar." This year's honorees, Gary Abusi, Rich Wildow, Sandra Weeks, and Sarah Mishak, have all given back to the Boulder community in unique ways. On top of being recognized at the gala, each honoree will also receive $1,000 to donate to a nonprofit group of his or her choice. Abusi is being recognized for his work with several nonprofit groups, including Make-A-Wish Colorado and Boulder-based youth homelessness nonprofit group TGTHR. He's been in Boulder for a long time, and throughout his career, he has continued to volunteer each and every year, DeKiefer said. Wildow is an ambassador for the Davis Finney Foundation, a Louisville nonprofit group that provides resources for people affected by Parkinson's. As an ambassador, Wildow shows community members how they can manage the disease through exercise, from biking and dancing to lifting weights. "He's definitely all about spreading the word about service in the community and trying to get other people to do that as well," Brown said. Weeks, president and project manager with Blue Spruce Construction Services, is being recognized for her outreach to local youth. WEEK supports higher education opportunities for all students and helps kids with hands-on projects like woodworking. She is obviously a woman in an industry that's been focused more on men, Brown said. She wants to help push children and students to pursue college education. Meshack is the lead attorney for Boulder Community Health and frequently gives talks on statewide health care issues. She also supports other nonprofit groups, including serving on the board of directors for the Boulder Shelter for the Homeless. I think that's a thread between all of the four that have been nominated this year. They've all done their volunteer work very quietly without a lot of attention being given to them, DeKiefer said. That's why we're so excited to highlight them. Tickets for the gala are already sold out, with around 180 guests registered for Saturday. The event is also the biggest fundraiser of the year for Boulder Rotary, with proceeds supporting the nonprofit group's other events and programs. Every Friday when I go to Rotary, I'm so inspired by the people in the room, Brown said. We're hoping that everybody who leaves this event will be inspired to try and go do even more great things. Peak to Peak, Spreading the Word. Students illustrate global issues through art and poetry, written by Amy Bounds. Monica Bunting's language arts classroom at Lafayette's Peak to Peak Charter School looks more like an art studio this week, with desks pushed to one side and paint, markers, fabric, brushes, glue guns, and other supplies covering several tables. Her students are turning small canvases into art pieces to illustrate poems they wrote about a global issue that they care about, along with note cards that detail possible solutions. Their goal is to draw attention to issues that range from climate change to racism to puppy mills to sustainable farming. I love that kids have a unique perspective on the world, Bunting said. We forget that kids are impacted by what they see on social media and the news. They have something to say, and they want their world to be different when they grow up. The students' projects will be displayed at Lafayette's East Simpson Coffee Company, 201 East Simpson Street. The grand opening for the exhibition is from 2 to 5 p.m. Sunday. They've just done a great job, Bunting said. I'm excited for them to have a platform. For the project, students started by researching problems they're passionate about. Using their research, they wrote a poem from the perspective of a person, animal, or even an inanimate object. Then they created the art pieces and brainstormed ways to address the root causes and consequences of those problems. The goal is to tap into empathy, Bunting said. Zoe Watkins, who has friends in the LGBTQ community, researched LGBTQ rights. Her poem is based on the story of Nex Benedict, a non-binary student in Oklahoma who was bullied, beaten, and later died. Benedict's death was ruled a suicide. Her art includes a rainbow flag, a road to represent marches, and a hospital to represent the bullying and violence LGBTQ people face. You have to make the art come to life to show others the issues, Watkins said. We need people to be aware. We can do something small, like using the correct pronoun, to make things better. Emiliano de la Torre Monge researched Cesar Chavez's social justice work to improve conditions for migrant farm workers. He said farm workers continue to be underpaid, even as they feed America. My grandpa was working farms, he said. It's something I'm really passionate about. Rhea Trivedi researched gender stereotypes in STEM fields, creating a collage that included pictures of famous women in STEM, money, and a tiny circuit board. They face a lot of prejudice for being women, and I don't think that's fair, she said. I want people to think about the prejudice they have and the things they say every day. Child labor in the fast fashion industry is another area students want to highlight. Olivia Bolt said she researched the brand she wears and found it was children my age making the clothes. I thought it was crazy and really sad, she said, adding that her piece shows a child underneath the fashion logos on her canvas to show the impact. Maya Pop said she couldn't stop researching the topic of pollution because she found it so interesting. She wrote a poem from the perspective of a sea turtle and used real trash from the cafeteria in her artwork, gluing on small bits to form a big pile. "I wanted to show how disgusting all the trash is," she said. "I want people to try to make more of an impact on it." Lillian Stoyer wanted to bring attention to the child labor used by the chocolate industry, using chocolate candy wrappers to show how widespread these practices are. She also included a list of the chocolate companies that don't use child labor, which gives people an alternative choice. "It doesn't get talked about enough," she said. "All of the big brands use child labor. There are kids as young as 12. They get human trafficked and have to work for 12 hours a day and get 85 cents for it. This is going to help people understand there is a lot more going on than what they know. The public needs to take a stance on this." Environment. Wolf connected to livestock killings could be breeding. Officials say they will not use lethal force or remove it. Written by Lauren Pennington. Wildlife officials said they will not remove a gray wolf potentially connected to recent livestock killings despite requests from ranchers. Two of the gray wolves reintroduced to Colorado's Grand County in December, including one suspected in recent depredations, are likely denning and in the breeding process, Colorado Parks and Wildlife officials said in a letter to the Middle Park Stock Growers Board Tuesday. The letter came in response to a request from the board to lethally remove two wolves suspected in the livestock attacks. Removing the male wolf would be irresponsible management and potentially cause the den to fail, possibly resulting in the death of the presumed pup, CPW Director Jeff Davis wrote in Tuesday's letter. In early April, the female wolf's GPS stopped uploading location points to the server and only started uploading again recently, according to Davis. Officials believe she was in the den, which interrupted the tracking caller's signal and aligns with the expected timing of wolf reproduction. CPW officers are working to confirm the den's location. Colorado's first confirmed wolf depredation incident happened on April 2nd in Grand County. The second attack came just 5 days later, 60 miles north in Jackson County. On April 18th, the total number of livestock killed by wolves reached six, as wildlife officials confirmed two more calf attacks. Amid reports of livestock attacks and depredations, one of the 10 gray wolves reintroduced to Colorado was found dead in Larimer County, federal officials confirmed Tuesday. Initial evidence shows the wolf likely died of natural causes, but an official autopsy has not yet been completed. The wolf population in Colorado is far below any restoration goal, Davis wrote in Tuesday's letter. "We have the legal duty to establish a self-sustaining population of wolves while minimizing conflict risk." As the wolf population in Colorado grows, the approach to lethal removals will likely become more liberal, Davis wrote. Attempted kidnapping at school. Parents demand independent investigation into response. Written by Saja Hindi. Parents of students at Black Forest Hills Elementary School in Aurora are demanding an independent investigation into the school's response to the attempted kidnapping of a child last week. A group of parents penned a letter to the Cherry Creek School District superintendent and board members calling for an immediate review of the incident that they wrote raised serious concerns about the safety of our children while under school care. Aurora police arrested Solomon Galligan, a 33-year-old man and registered sex offender, about 3 hours after he allegedly went to the school on Friday and, while holding a white blanket, walked up to children who were playing outside during recess. Police said he then lunged toward the kids and tried to grab one of them as the students started to run away. Students began screaming, "Stranger danger," and that's when the suspect apparently left the school, according to an arrest report. The school notified parents of the incident in a brief message on Friday afternoon and sent two more messages on Friday night and Sunday about law enforcement contact with the suspect. On Monday, Principal Amanda Replogle sent another email with an explanation of what occurred, an apology for not bringing all students inside right away when the suspect approached students, and what security measures would be taken to make students feel safe. School district spokesperson Lauren Snell shared those emails with the Denver Post, but declined to comment further until the suspect had been formally charged. He is scheduled to appear in court on Thursday. The parents calling for more accountability and transparency, however, say that's not enough, and that there were failures on multiple levels that put their kids in danger, including ignoring safety protocols. They want the district to make permanent changes. This is now being treated as a near miss, Shannon McCorrison told the Denver Post of the district's response, and the fact is a kid was attacked. He was attacked whether it was successful or not. McCorrison is the parent of a third grader at the school and is one of the parents behind the effort to put pressure on the school and district to take action. In the letter sent to officials Tuesday, McCorrison and other parents called for temporarily reassigning administrators who were involved in the incident response to duties without direct student contact until an investigation concludes. And they requested that the school hold an open meeting with parents about how the school handled the situation, including failures that day, and implement permanent enhanced security measures at the school. It took nearly an hour before police were notified of the incident, according to a timeline compiled by Nicole Jass, one of the parents who spoke to people involved. The school was not placed on a secure perimeter, which would get students and staff inside the school and prevent anyone from exiting or anyone else from entering the school during the threat. Students were allowed to continue going outside to play, even though administrators didn't know where the suspect had gone, Jass said. It took at least another 20 minutes before parents were notified that anything had happened at the school, and students were allowed to leave school grounds alone, the timeline said. Jass, the mother of a third grader and fifth grader at the school, became angrier the more she learned about the incident and what school administrators failed to do, she said. Her daughter was outside and saw the boys running from the man, but the students remained outside for a while before staff members brought them inside, Jass said. Later that same day, her younger son was allowed to go outside to play. On Monday, Jass was among about 60 parents who demanded to speak to the principal. Replogle admitted that this wasn't the first time unauthorized people have made it onto the school grounds in front of students, McCorrison said. The parents want to hear directly from district leaders about the conclusions of any investigations and how these situations will be prevented in the future. They haven't received a response to their letter or an online petition, also demanding a comprehensive review. The kids all did the right thing and were told to calm down and go on with business as normal, McCorrison said. The kids were made to feel like their alarm was incorrect, and the adults didn't act the way they've been trained to act. That is intolerable to me. Thank you for joining us for the Boulder, Longmont, and Northern Colorado News, read by Jerry Gingras.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.